Welcome back to The Horse Race, your weekly look at politics, policy, and elections in Massachusetts. I'm Stephanie Murray, author of the Politico Massachusetts Playbook.
And I'm Steve Gazella, president of the Massing Polling Group. And we are here back in the pod studio, which is currently under construction. We actually have a new soundproof pod studio, not the sort of glassed-in bunker we've been recording in for all these months.
We're moving up, and it's very exciting.
It is exciting. So we'll post some pictures of that later on Twitter. So I say we're back here because last week, of course, was the big horse race live event where we had Attorney General Maura Healey and Joe Kennedy III. So we started with Attorney General Healey, asked her about some issues in the news. So, of course, she was just off the big court date with Purdue Pharma, where the court refused to dismiss the lawsuit that she had filed against the Sackler family for their role in the opioid crisis. We also got into what I thought was interesting, and Stephanie, I'm interested in your thoughts on this, about sort of how she sees her role, both in terms of here in the state and in terms of how she thinks about her interactions with the Trump administration. What did you take away from all that?
Yeah, it's definitely an unusual time to be an attorney general in this country under President Donald Trump, when so much of your time kind of has to be spent pushing back on the president and his administration instead of focusing on state issues. But it seems to me like Attorney General Healey has really been able to do both. We really drilled down into talking about Pilgrim Nuclear as well, but it was great to hear from her about how she sees her role.
Yeah, so I mean, she signaled very early on that she was going to be taking on the Trump administration in court, and she's done just that. We asked her how she approaches that, and let's take a listen to what she had to say.
I mean, what you're trying to do is hold the line. You're trying to keep bad things from happening. So it's not exactly where you want to be, but it's necessary, and I'm glad we've had the success and been able to go to court to take on affronts to the Constitution.
So, of course, we also had to ask her about whether she might run for governor in a few years or maybe Senate, what her next aspiration would be. And that's a question that many of you had on Twitter as well. She didn't quite say what her next plans are. She said she's happy doing her job.
Yes. And of course, we also had to ask her whether she can meet Charlie Baker in basketball, just because that's something that is on everybody's mind. She also wouldn't answer that, though, unfortunately, though I would definitely watch if they ever played one-on-one. Our other guest, of course, was Congressman Joe Kennedy III, who, of course, is challenging Senator Ed Markey in the Democratic primary next year. We asked him just about sort of the whys and the wherefores of his run. Stephanie, what did you take away from the things he had to say?
It sounds to me like he's still working on framing his run, which to me makes sense. I mean, he's out, he's talking to people across the state, trying to figure out what it is that people want in a senator. But that really succinct answer about why he's running for Senate, why he needs to be in there instead of Ed Markey, not totally clear yet.
So you also asked him about the changing face of the Democratic Party and sort of the issue of representation and what this race could do to that.
Yeah, and this is something that's been kind of kicking around in my head, the question of representation in the Democratic Party, when so many Democrats have been talking about why it's important to have people of different identities, whether it's people of color, women in office. And so I asked Congressman Kennedy about that. Why should it be you instead of a woman or a person of color to hold the Senate seat next?
100% identity is important. You're not going to separate identity, literally who you are, from the values that you bring or the way that you perceive are going to interpret certain issues or the way you're going to go about fighting for the issues that you want to fight about or elevating the voices you want to elevate, of course. I just think that what's incumbent upon that process is that people step forward and run, and you make your case.
Then, of course, we also asked a number of policy questions. There are differences that are coming to the fore between his views and Ed Markey's views on some issues, sort of where they've been and where they're going. I'd really recommend you go listen to the whole thing. He gets into, you know, his views on marijuana policy and how those have evolved, how he sees his record on climate change and so forth. These are the big questions, though, that are going to keep popping up for Kennedy. Why you? Why now?
And these are a lot of the questions that came up when we posed the question to you guys on Twitter. So thanks for reaching out and giving us your questions as well.
So that's Joe Kennedy and what he's doing in terms of the Senate race. But of course, there are other candidates running, or there have been other candidates running, and there's news on that front too. Stephanie, what's going on?
Steve Pemberton, who was running for Senate along with Mark E. Kennedy and labor attorney Shannon Liss Reardon, is out. He raised around $500,000 this quarter, which ended September 30th. But he sent out this long, lengthy statement kind of decrying the way our politics are now and saying that it was just impossible to break in with family legacy and institutional support helping out other candidates. So wonder who that would have been about.
I was going to say, so the thrust basically is Kennedy on one and Markey on the other. Is that sort of what he seemed to be getting at?
That is the sense that I got. But the other issue here is that he moved here recently. He's not been kind of involved in Massachusetts Democratic politics for decades. He was in Chicago. He moved to Framingham, started running for Senate. So I think that name recognition was another big issue for him.
Yeah, and probably the network, too, I would think, because even though lots of candidates who are well-known in their particular sort of slice of the world, you know, may have a strong network, they still may not be known to voters. But in his case, it sounds like it was some element of both of those things. Well, that wraps us up on Senate news. Of course, we meet and we record in this glorious pod studio on Wednesdays, which means last night was the Democratic debate. Stephanie, I know you are watching. What did you take away from it?
My takeaway was that it was a pretty good night for Bernie Sanders. This was his first big public appearance since he had a heart attack a few weeks ago. And I was watching CNN, which the debate was on, and right after it wrapped up, they weren't talking about his age or his performance. They were talking about his endorsement from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the representative from New York. So he was able to kind of shift the conversation and roll the ball forward. Even after 3 hours of debate, they were all talking about AOC.
And of course, that brings up an interesting Massachusetts connection to harken back to Lauren Dozensky saying that there's always a connection, which is Bernie Sanders was endorsed by AOC, also Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, three of the four members of, I guess, what we've officially dubbed the squad now. Our own Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley from here in Massachusetts did not endorse Bernie Sanders. And put out a statement today sort of explaining why that was. I think that underscores in some ways what we've said here in Massachusetts and what the national media, I think, has picked up on somewhat less, but a little bit, is, you know, she's doesn't really share as much in common with them as the three of them do. You know, she's a bit more of an establishment politician, and there's a bit of distance between her and them ideologically. So just interesting that she didn't join them, and, you know, we'll sort of keep an eye on who she does decide to endorse. In terms of the debate itself, Bernie Sanders, yes, I thought he had a good night. I mean, there was a lot of eyes on him, I think, just to see how he recovered from his heart condition and sort of how he looked. He seemed like he had just the usual amount of Bernie Sanders energy. The other thing that stuck out to me was that everybody was going after Elizabeth Warren. So, of course, she now is either one of or just the front runner. So I think we should expect that. But just to see that the other candidates kind of get that now, too. You know, it's not all about Joe Biden. It's not all about Bernie Sanders. Now, there was a lot of incoming directed at Elizabeth Warren.
But it became kind of about Joe Biden to me, and from what I saw on Twitter when he made that comment about the CFPB saying that he got the votes for her and he kind of stuck his arm out and put his hand kind of close to her face. A lot of women were talking about that and kind of how they've had that feeling dealing with men in their lives or in the workplace or something like that. Kind of it read to a lot of people that he was kind of taking credit for her work when that credit wasn't due for him. It was for her. So I think it's an interesting preview, since now that she's polling so highly, kind of the conversations about sexism and women that we kind of started to have with Hillary Clinton, and now we're going to see them with Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, that was definitely an uncomfortable moment for just to watch sort of visually. And I think in many ways, it sort of echoes some of the challenges that Joe Biden faces in sort of updating his approach, we'll call it. You know, I mean, he before this race, I think, had sort of a way that he behaved, which was comfortable to him, but is not perhaps reflective of the most up-to-date ways that people approach, you know, sort of interpersonal relationships. Trying to think of a delicate way to put this.
I was talking to one of my friends, and they were saying, why don't at every commercial break we just have the American people vote two of these people off the stage and kind of condense the debate as the night goes on? But it kind of seemed to me that they did that. By the end of the night, it really was Sanders, Biden, Warren talking, and kind of Klobuchar and Buttigieg and Harris trying to jump in, raise their hands, and get in on the action. But by the end of the night, they really let those top three candidates duke it out.
Yeah, and I think, though, you've even perhaps by omission identified the couple that might have been removed had that been done, which, you know, I thought Klobuchar and Mayor Pete actually did get in some, but yep. Then, you know, there's still Castro and Booker and Tulsi Gabbard, who I don't know. They were there, I guess. Tom Steyer. I didn't even mention him. So, but I do like the idea of using a reality show style format of just like yanking very random candidates off the stage.
Not to make it all about The Bachelor, but I think they have some very interesting comparison techniques. Maybe a 3-on-1 where one person gets kicked out in the middle or something like that.
But how are they selected? Because like The Bachelor, that's one person who then gets to decide. Whereas you compare that to like American Idol, where the American people vote by calling in, or Survivor, where they all get together and they vote one of their competitors off.
You know? You have so. Such an innocent view, Steve. It is all producers. It is all created to create drama.
Oh,
producers pulling the
I
strings.
It was all authentic. I thought The Bachelor was all about finding love.
Jen's, oh boy.
Yeah, Jen's going to die when she hears this segment. Anyway, we do have real things to do here today. So we have two fantastic guests for you.
Yes, we do. We have Boston City Councilor Michelle Wu, who wants to scrap the Boston Planning and Development Agency and start all over again.
And we're also sort of rolling our way through the four-month period of Governor Charlie Baker's vaping sales ban. So to talk about that, I caught up with Allison Perrin of the Heart Association. So their group has legislation on vaping and smoking in general, and I wanted to get her thoughts on the ban because they're not what you might think.
All right, let's get to it.
Our first guest joined the Boston City Council in 2014 and has put forth a long list of policy ideas ever since. When T fares were set to go up, she instead proposed a completely free MBTA. A partial list of other proposals includes residential parking fees in Boston, a $15 minimum wage, more and better bike lanes, a harbor transit network, congestion tolling, curbside composting, universal pre-K, net zero building codes, and much more. Her most recent proposal, causing a stir, would end the Boston Planning and Development Agency, or BPDA. She's here to talk about the mechanics and implications of this proposal and more. And as a returning guest of the pod, she gets a horse race title. So she is the boss of big ideas. Boston City Councilor Michelle Wu, thank you for being here.
It's great to be here.
So a lot of your proposals seem to point in a pretty different direction than where Boston's headed. Would you take the city in a different direction than the direction it seems to be going right now?
I think across the country, we are facing a sense of urgency that is deep, that is big, that demands bold action. And we see it in the conversations around the presidential race, and we see it at all of the many, many candidate forums for Boston City Council at large as well, that people across every neighborhood of the city know that Boston has the resources, has the energy, has the grassroots activism to do more and bigger and better and faster and more equitably, but that we need to put the pieces together for that. And so it's been exciting to try to drive conversation and empower organizing around it.
So let's talk about your plan to get rid of the BPDA. And what really struck me in this document, which was dozens and dozens of pages, I mean, what, like 75 pages or something like
including
that?
Including the end notes.
Something you identify so many issues. I mean, you say that Boston's facing an affordable housing crisis. We have the worst traffic congestion in the entire country, and we're facing down a climate crisis that threatens the existence of the city. So what does getting rid of the BPDA have to do with all of these giant issues?
The genesis of the report was really reflecting on the learnings and the constituent services and the hearings and in my role as chair of the Committee on Planning, Development, and Transportation, which revolved around many of the very urgent crises that you just talked about. And all of those issues end up being related to and fundamentally driven by how and whether the city does planning in a big picture way. So when we have a development process that is parcel by parcel, negotiation by negotiation, where most of the construction in Boston happens because that project needed to have a special exception to the zoning code, and our base zoning code dates back to the 60s, it's not only stressful for residents who are constantly asking their local elected officials to stand with them and ask for something better in their neighborhood. It's stressful for developers who have no predictability around the process. And it also means that we are missing out on putting together the pieces in that big picture way when it comes to traffic and transportation planning, when it comes to resiliency and building that in across the entire city, not just building by building, and when it comes to affordability, where we are seeing growth that has in some ways has exacerbated all of these challenges.
But is this a problem with the specific agency? I mean, you're talking, it sounds like some of what you're addressing is specific to the process that would go into approving a specific development. How much of that has to do with the BPTA itself, and what would getting rid of the BPDA improve on any of those issues?
Yeah, the report is about how and why to abolish this agency, but it's really a question of how and when Boston will be willing to let go of a system of development driven by special approvals and influence. And at the heart of it, there are a couple pieces that are unique to the structure of this agency and therefore the development process. First is that it is a self-funded agency, so it's not funded by the city budget, and therefore the activities are not subject to the same level of oversight through the city council's budget process that every other city department is accountable to. And we've seen some lapses in accountability stemming from that. The other piece is that the agency's creation in the 1950s, in 1957, this Boston Redevelopment Authority came out of a federal urban renewal push where the specific goal was to facilitate development in a rapid, large-scale, fast, big, immediate way, often at the expense of community and neighborhoods, often at the expense of poor and working class and very diverse neighborhoods, immigrant neighborhoods like the West End. And we see that same concentration of power exist today and the same facilitation of development at the expense of residents having a true voice in the process. And I want to be clear, because we've gotten some back and forth of, how could we justify a system having more hearings, more process, more opportunity to go back and forth. And that is not at all what the report is saying. In fact, I'm not sure we could get a more complicated process than we have today, where every proposal requires back and forth with community and dozens of meetings and years of permitting. Instead, we should move to what many of our peer cities do, which is planning that is driven by community involvement and conversations, so that the needs of the community are then reflected in the rules that are codified into zoning. And then there is a development review, permitting, and inspection all together, rather than how we have it today, where that part is all spread out.
So when we talk about community and development, I mean, a lot of the conversation shifts to housing. And in your view, and we got a lot of smart questions about this on Twitter as well. So in your view, Boston's goal of 69,000 new units of housing by 2030, is that just right, too much, too little? What do you think about that?
You know, I think in some ways, when we're just picking a number, and that number is even from a little bit ago, and that number was revised up from the 53,000 figure that had first been proposed. And, I don't know all the details about what the assumptions were that went into that, and how, presumably it's some matching of projected demand with the sort of capacity of the city to absorb new housing in different places. But if we're not having a conversation about planning that not only should dictate where those 69,000 or however many units there will be, where those units should go, but also recognizing that planning itself affects the demand for new housing in the city and where that demand has impacts differently. When we just talk about sort of a number plucked out of, a number of metrics or arrived at with some calculations, but we're not attaching the planning to it, that 69,000 unit figure ends up being for the developers to drive. And we see that it will result in some places, a free-for-all of development going where the perceived pushback will be least from the neighborhood, where it may seem cheapest to build because there's a chance to buy something that is zoned lower and try to use the process, use influence, and go through the community process to upzone that specific parcel. It doesn't lead to an organized, thoughtful, and sustainable process for the city to address not only the housing that we need, but the impacts of where it makes sense to put however many units.
I want to follow up, though, just a little bit on the magnitude of what the need might be and sort of how you see that. We've heard a lot in focus groups over the last few years that development and economic development are starting to take almost a negative tone on in some ways, that that people feel like their area is full and that there's no way to get around anymore and that, you know, it's just too crowded. And we got a question on Twitter that I thought the way it was phrased sort of got to that as well, which was, should we ask our poorest neighborhoods to shoulder most of the burden of providing new housing for the city, or should we demand that wealthier, higher demand neighborhoods should shoulder more of it, even if they don't want to? Shoulder and burden were the two words that sort of stuck out to me, because, you know, the way that I think often elected leaders talk about it is that economic development and development writ large are positives. So 69,000 units may not be the right number, but is a high number desirable, or do these people have a point?
It's really a conversation that extends. I mean, you could have just as easily have subbed out neighborhoods for cities and towns as well. Right. This is a regional conversation that Boston is certainly a big player within. But even to get to the appropriate number really should be a larger planning exercise and a larger planning, ongoing planning effort among the cities in the greater Boston region, the cities and towns in the greater Boston region. So I think what people are feeling across every neighborhood of the city is that we have seen traffic get a lot worse in the last few years. We have seen home prices go up, the cost of rent now the third most expensive in the country. We have seen the resiliency and the vulnerability. We have seen Boston's climate vulnerability begin to take shape in a more intense way than ever before. And all things considered, it's important to have opportunities. It's great to celebrate businesses wanting to locate here and jobs and Boston being a hub for economic activity. But we have to be realistic that every time we're attracting a new company, every time we are incentivizing a large corporation to move here, there needs to be the conversation about how we will accommodate those new people, the workers, the housing, the transit impacts. At this point, the failure of the MBTA is making growth really a burden. And it doesn't have to be that way, but it really depends on us putting all the pieces together and how all the issues interconnect, starting with, I think, housing and transit and climate.
So I'll ask you one more question about the BPDA, and then we'll move on to some other stuff because there's plenty to talk about. But even in your own report, you point out that calling for changes to this agency is pretty common on the campaign trail for mayoral candidates. You point out Boston Mayor Marty Walsh has called for it, but those calls, once the campaign is over, seem to go unfulfilled. So what makes this proposal different, and what's the logic in bringing this agency or agencies under City Hall control instead of letting it have its own autonomy?
Yeah, I think it's important to note that every time the city has the opportunity to have a big conversation about our future, this issue comes up: development and planning and whether this structure, you know, first the BRA, now called the BPDA, is really the best fit. And more often than not, there is a call to change it. But as noted, it still exists today, you know, six decades later after the creation. And some of that is the power of the agency politically, but also just from a sheer ability to kind of muscle things through, sometimes at the expense of community voice. But the other part of that is that it is a rather complicated entity created by state law, extended through city council votes and other state approvals. So one big goal of the report was to lay out step by step what are the legal mechanisms, what are the exact actions that the city and the state would have to take to unwind this agency. And so the whole second to last section of the report details the three processes that we would have to undergo. And in fact, concluding that we could effectively dismantle the agency without state approval by transferring the assets over to the city so that they're fully on the city books, restoring city oversight over all of the operations and the personnel and the actions of this agency, we would essentially be moving that. We could do that in a short time frame. The next step would be to have the city planning department, again, fully accountable to the city council and the residents, embark on a citywide planning effort. We have not had a citywide master plan that then was codified into zoning since 1964, 1965 in Boston. And that is the reason why we don't have clear rules that apply across the board. There essentially are no rules that apply to development right now, and it is based on how much each developer thinks that he or she will be able to win from the community and from the regulators. And I think your last question is really the crux of it. This is about an agency that currently has autonomy, that is not subject to the same type of oversight, making huge decisions that will impact the future of our city for generations to come. That type of government action should be subject to full oversight. And it's very important that we move that back onto the city books, back subject to city council and public oversight.
So I want to pose a couple questions that we got from people on Twitter because we put out the call for questions and got some very interesting ones. This one comes from Stephen D. Schmidt, who says, cities like New York City are making bus-only streets like 14th Street, and San Francisco is banning cars on some streets. What are some big things like that that you think Boston could do?
This is so important. Buses are the single fastest, most cost-effective, most impactful way that we could improve public transit. And cities have so much authority to do that. It's not just about waiting for a quasi-independent state agency in the FMCB and the MBTA to find the funding. We could dedicate bus lanes. We could expand bus priority. It's often a conversation about making the trade-off between on-street parking and a bus lane, or giving up a space where people are in individual vehicles and letting buses, which will serve just magnitudes more commuters, go through at a faster rate. We could be talking differently about signal prioritization. And so this is a real focus. I think it's also really important to note that this is a huge equity issue too. Bus riders in Boston across all racial backgrounds take the bus at about the same rates. And yet Black bus riders spend 64 hours more per year stuck on the bus than white bus riders on average. And this is because routes that run through communities of color tend to get delayed more often, tend to require a longer distance between the most popular origin and destination stations, or transfers in between. And so what we can do, whatever we can do to speed up buses, is a direct contribution to equity in our city as well.
And I have to point to one more question that we got many times from our listeners on Twitter. What's next for you? I mean, are you looking at running for mayor in 2021?
This is such an important election year. And what's next is 3 weeks to go until November 5th. We have a huge opportunity in Boston this year to remake the city council, to break some important barriers that it's taken a long time to get close to. But 2019 could be the year that Boston elects a majority female city council, a majority people of color, depending on how various district races and the at-large race plays out. So I encourage everyone to remind your friends, mark the date, November 5th. It's going to make a big, big difference. We'll have a historic council, and we could get a lot done next year.
All right, Boston City Councilor Michelle Wu, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been great to be here. Thank you.
It's time to talk about vaping. Vaping was initially pitched as a less dangerous alternative to smoking, or even a way to help quit smoking. But that's not how things are unfolding now. Teen addiction rates are off the charts, and the dangers of vaping are starting to become very clear. In response to growing questions about the health impacts, Governor Charlie Baker announced a 4-month ban on the sale of vaping products in Massachusetts last month. But not everyone is on board with the ban, including some public health advocates who we'd count as definitely on board with fighting the spread of vaping. Steve caught up with one of them, friend of the pod and queen of hearts, Allison Perrin of the American Heart Association. Here's what she had to say.
So, Allison, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So we have a 4-month ban that's been in place for a couple weeks now, which I guess if you weren't really paying attention, sounds like something that the Heart Association would support. But you say it's more complicated than that.
Yeah, I think for us, you know, we applauded the governor for recognizing that there was an issue around kind of acute respiratory illnesses that were popping up. And the common denominator was that everyone was getting them from some sort of vaping. And so he did kind of have to hit pause and figure out what was causing this and look at it. But for us, you know, we are looking at this more long term. Why are kids starting on this to begin with? you know, something a little bit more comprehensive, something more permanent. So we're looking for a legislative solution. We've been working since the session started on banning all flavors and all tobacco products, because what we know is, you know, somewhere between 80 to 90% of kids are starting this product because of the flavors. That's what's enticing them to start. And, you know, decades of research have shown that both pricing and flavor bans are the most effective way to stop kids from using tobacco.
A couple weeks back, we had Shailene Title from the Cannabis Control Commission on to talk about some of the potentially unintended side effects of just an outright ban, which is that it could push people who are addicted to nicotine to use other products. Is that something that's of concern to you as well, or are your concerns mostly about the flavors and what's getting kids addicted?
You know, it's always worrisome, because if you have a group of people who are severely addicted to nicotine, then they can't quit, and they're not going to seek, you know, an actual FDA-approved cessation device to quit, like the patch or gum or the drugs, that they would go back and they'd switch to combustible cigarettes, for instance. You know, the concern of the black market's always there, likely, you know, much so for marijuana than it would be for tobacco.
Okay, and there is actually some legislation that you already had sort of working its way through the State House on that would achieve the policy goals that you've outlined here. Talk about how it's different from what the governor's put in place, and sort of where is that bill right now as it works its way through the committee structure?
Yeah, so the House bill, which is sponsored by Representative Daniel Gregoires in House Ways and Means, and the Senate version, which is sponsored by Senator John Keenan, is in Senate Ways and Means, so they could take it up any time. And I think the legislature is recognizing that there's a need to do something. So this would ban all flavors and all tobacco, so meaning not just e-cigarettes. So we know there's about 15,000 different types of flavors in e-cigarette products, but in 2009, when the federal government banned flavors in cigarettes, they left out, they created kind of a loophole and left out menthol, mint, and wintergreen. So you are still able to get menthol cigarettes or wintergreen skull or some flavored kind of cigarillos or cigars. And so we want to make sure that we're closing the whole loophole on flavors.
And what's the pushback on that? Why has, first of all, why do they do it? And second of all, why is menthol more controversial perhaps than some of the, you know, bubble gum? And I think you said unicorn poop was a flavor that existed.
Yeah.
Why is menthol different than those?
So I think, you know, over the years, menthol equates to about 20% of sales for combustible cigarettes. And so the industry really does want to save menthol cigarettes. The industry's also targeted more minority communities. So you certainly see higher use in minority communities. And so they lobbied the federal government industry very hard in 2009, and that was why it was left out. And we just want to close that loophole.
And menthol also plays a prominent role in getting kids addicted to nicotine in the first place, right?
Yeah, so mint and menthol are actually the most popular flavors, both in e-cigarettes and in cigarettes. And so what we're seeing is rates of about 50 to 60% of kids are using menthol cigarettes compared to about 30% of adults. So it's almost twice the level of that. And for e-cigarettes, kids are using them at six times the rate of adults. So you're certainly seeing more kids use these products.
So it seems like some of the more exotic or newer flavors are what are getting kids addicted to nicotine, mostly through vaping, if I'm understanding what you're saying correctly. Why not just, you know, take the win? In other words, take the flavored vaping product ban rather than trying to expand it to all flavored tobacco products.
Yeah, so menthol's a flavor, and we want to make sure that all flavors are treated the same. And so for us, it's really about making sure that kids aren't going to, you know, get off of e-cigarettes and go to, you know, combustible cigarettes because there's still flavors available. We want to make sure that there aren't any flavors available to kids.
And there's, of course, one other product which was covered by the ban and which always plays a major role when we're talking about vaping. And, of course, that's marijuana products. Where is the hard association on the inclusion of those in the current ban or any future legislation that you all are considering?
Yeah, so we never took a position on the marijuana except to say that we believe that people should not be allowed to smoke marijuana anywhere where you can't smoke a cigarette, so that there's still, obviously, cardiovascular risks to secondhand smoke of that. And so, you know, our bill doesn't touch marijuana, so we do believe that it's, you know, from that standpoint, it's a bit of a compromise where it doesn't address that.
So the eternal and perhaps unanswerable question about any legislation is, when are we expecting movement on it?
Yeah, so we are very hopeful that we will see it in the next few weeks. We know that the legislature takes a little bit of a break after November 20th. And so when they come back after the holidays in January, the ban will be almost up. And so we really do feel like they need to take action, you know, this month or next month to really make sure that we have something in place to continue once the ban is up.
And the ban runs through
January 26th,
all right.
I believe is the date.
So one issue that's sort of been fascinating and a bit surprising to insiders is that Martha Coakley actually went to work for Juul a few months back. Have you run across her in terms of working on the issue here in Massachusetts?
We have not seen her in Massachusetts. I'm not sure of her role. I would have to assume that she was playing a bigger role in strategy at the federal level, trying to work on how to ensure that FDA, you know, continues to allow these products on the market. But we have not seen her in Massachusetts.
So we had the first ban here, but it sounds like other states have followed suit since then?
Yeah, so there's a number of governors that have taken action. Michigan was the first one. Then New York put something out, but has kind of is waiting more for the legislature to start. But Massachusetts is the strictest ban on vaping because it banned all vape products, which is slightly fascinated by, you know, her connection to Massachusetts.
Interesting. All right. Well, Allison Perrin of the American Heart Association, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, well, it's time for trivia. We had the live podcast last week, so there's no question pending from last time. But we have a question this week. Senator Elizabeth Warren is always out on the campaign trail, but when she comes home and stops at her favorite bar, she has a very specific order. What food and drink does Warren order at her favorite place?
It's a cheesy snack, which I like. We've done several Twitter polls on, like, which puffed cheesy snack is our people's favorite.
And it's honestly a pretty good order, though.
It's a good one.
I would do the same.
It's deeply American, I think, so we'll take it. Anyway, so shameless plug time. If you aren't already, I can't believe you're listening to this podcast and not subscribed to Stephanie's Morning Playbook, so definitely go out and subscribe if you're not. And leave us ratings and reviews wherever you listen to your podcast. That helps people find us. And if you need polling, give us a ring.
I think that'll do it for today. I'm Stephanie Murray of the Politico Massachusetts Playbook.
And I'm Steve Gazzella of the Massing Polling Group. Our inveterate producer is Libby Gormley. Thank you, everybody, for listening.